The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Two commentaries, then we're going to go to our in-studio in New York with Richard Gale and Kara Lee. And then we'll be continuing our program with questions and statements from people in the audience. And since I'm not at a computer and can't, I'll have them give out the numbers. But a brief commentary. When I hear about how good the economy is doing and look at Wall Street numbers, I'm appalled. Do you remember the massive wave of subprime mortgages that defaulted in 2007 and 2008 and caused the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression? Well, according to global research, the second wave of mortgage defaults is on the way, and there's simply no way that we're going to be able to avoid it. A huge mountain of mortgages is going to reset starting in the next 6 months. Now, once those mortgage payments go up, there are once again going to be millions of Americans who simply cannot pay their mortgages. Let's just say that right now your mortgage is at 5%. Well, it can go up to 7%, or let's say it's 6%, it's going to go up to 8%. And that means that you're going to end up seeing massive problems. Now, then you also have the Federal Housing Administration has announced a plan to increase the amount of upfront cash paid by new borrowers and to require higher down payments from those with the poorest credit. The Federal Housing Administration currently backs about 30% of all new home loans and about 20% of all new home refinancing loans. Tighter standards, which I agree with, are going to mean that less people will qualify for loans. Less qualifiers means there will be less buyers for homes. Less buyers means that home prices are going to drop even more. I predicted on this show, and I will stand behind it, that over the next 24 months, I predict in most places in the United States, property values will drop between 20 and 50%, including in Manhattan. Now, quite simply, I believe most people shouldn't be buying anything right now. I believe you should be selling what you can because I believe we're going into a 10-year downward and accelerated bad place. And also, it's getting really hard to find a job in the United States. There are 6,130,000 workers who are unemployed for 26 weeks or more. And that was the most ever since the U.S. government started keeping track of statistics in 1948. In fact, it is more than double the 2,612,000 U.S. workers who were unemployed for a similar length of period in 2008. The reality is that once Americans lose their jobs, they are increasingly finding it difficult to find new ones. And in December, there was also 929,000 discouraged workers. Ah, what does that mean? It means that you've looked for work and you can't find it. So suddenly you're out of all the statistics. You no longer exist. You're just invisible. But you do exist. Not according to the government. In some areas, the U.S. are already virtually in a state of depression. The mayor of Detroit estimates that real unemployment in his city is over 50%. And did we not hear today that Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the state capital, is going to declare bankruptcy or thinking that is an option? I predict that we will have anywhere from 50 to 200 cities, small and large, declaring bankruptcy, which means that bondholders are going to get wiped on that. Now, states cannot declare bankruptcy, even though California, New York, and New Jersey are bankrupt, and Florida is bankrupt. And they will not have the courage to make the cuts necessary and stop many of the increases in pensions and do the things they have to do. And they're going to start increasing taxes across the board, and that's going to mean that people who can barely afford to hold their head above water are going to be sunk. So you're going to start seeing states like Texas and Montana and states that have homestead laws and states that don't have all these high taxes become the place where people are going to relocate. For decades, our leaders in Washington pushed us towards a global economy. Big mistake. They told us, Democrats and Republicans, that it would be good for us. Well, now we're seeing the dark side. Now workers in the United States must compete with workers all over the world. And our greedy corporations, gee, that's redundant, are free to pursue the cheapest labor available anywhere on the globe. And millions of jobs have already been shipped out. Thank you to Bill Clinton, and now thank you, Barack Obama. Princeton University economist Alan Blinder estimates that up to 29% of all people currently working, you heard me right, all of you currently working, you're going to have your jobs offshored within the next 20 years. It'll probably come in the next 10 years. The days when blue-collar workers could live the American dream, that's history, friends. Get over it. That's never going to happen again in your lifetimes. And during the 2001 recession, the U.S. economy lost 2% of its jobs and took 4 years to get back on track. To Sean Hannity, I'm going to be doing a commentary in the next 2 weeks to show you that your praise, your almost cult-like adherence to Reaganomics is all false. You haven't done your homework, Sean. I don't consider you a bad person. I just consider you misguided, much like I do Glenn Beck. The difference is that you keep believing that let the free market bring back the day. Kill big government? No. Reduce big government to make it efficient. Get rid of corruption, cronyism, subcontractors, and have insight and bring back the rules and regulations that actually protect us. You want us to believe that it's all about free up the hands. Which hands you talking about, Sean? Mine? And others like me? The 6 million small business people that are ethical and honest and work hard? Yeah, that would be good if we stimulated our capacity to increase the workforce. That's always what's worked. Helping big corporatists? No, Sean, I don't ship jobs off to China. The people you back do. Ronald Reagan did. Bill Clinton did. George Bush Jr. did. And Barack Obama is. So just look, I'll be doing a detailed, comprehensive, scholarly, footnoted reference that everything you spout about Ronald Reagan is wrong. So once and for all, let's get it right. That doesn't mean you're going to stop believing it. That's your right. But at least anyone with a brain will be able to challenge you when they call in on your show and have good statistics to challenge you with. Now, as I mentioned, we lost 2% of our jobs, and it took 4 years in 2001. But guess what? We're now over 5.5% of our jobs lost, and there's no sign that we're going to let up on this till we get about 8% of our jobs lost. So you're looking at least 10 years before we can start to gain our footing again. And all this unemployment is putting severe stress on state unemployment funds. At this point, 25 state unemployment insurance funds have gone broke. And the Department of Labor estimates 15 more state unemployment funds will go broke within the next 2 years and will need massive loans from the federal government just to keep going. So you're talking about 40 out of 50 states won't have unemployment insurance for the unemployed. 39 million Americans currently receive food stamps, and it's expanding at 20,000 people a day. So the America that we now know is virtually starving, 20,000 a day. The number of Americans who are going broke is staggering. 1.41 million Americans filed for personal bankruptcy last year, 32% over 2008, and it's up this year. For decades, the fact that the U.S. dollar was the reserve currency of the world gave the U.S. financial system an unusual degree of stability. But all that is changing. Foreign countries are increasingly turning away from the dollar to other currencies. For example, Russia's central bank announced last week that it had started buying Canadian dollars to diversify its foreign exchange reserves. And recent economic downturns has left some localities totally bankrupt. For instance, Jefferson County, Alabama, is on the brink of what would be the largest government bankruptcy in the history of the United States, surpassing the 1994 filing by Southern California's Orange County. I think theirs was $3 billion at the time. The U.S. is facing a pension crisis of unprecedented magnitude. Virtually all pension funds in the United States, both private and public, are massively underfunded. And with millions of baby boomers, my generation, getting ready to retire, there's simply no way on earth that all those obligations can be met. It's not going to happen. And Robert Marks of the University of Chicago and Joshua Rawl of Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management recently calculated the collective unfunded pension liability of all 50 U.S. states to be $3.2 trillion. Social Security and Medicare expenses are widely out of control. Once again, with millions of baby boomers now at retirement age, there's simply going to be no way to pay all those retirees what they are owed. So will the U.S. government come to the rescue? The U.S. has allowed the total federal debt to balloon by 50% in 4 years to $12.3 trillion. So they're not going to be the riding the right horse. The U.S. government has learned nothing about its mistakes. In fact, some Democrats this past Wednesday proposed allowing the federal government to borrow an additional $2 trillion to pay its bills. That's really stupid. It's going to become even harder for the U.S. government to pay the bills now that tax receipts are falling through the floor and U.S. corporate income tax receipts were down 55%, all because of how they've gotten the ability to work around the tax regulations. Now, if every corporation in the United States had by law to pay the same percentage of tax, we would be out of this hole. But that won't happen as long as Republicans are in power. When it comes to filibustering this, and also all the Democrats who are blue dog Democrats who are just Republicans in drag. So where will the U.S. government get the money? From the Federal Reserve? Of course. The Federal Reserve bought approximately 80% of all U.S. Treasury securities last year. In other words, the U.S. government is now being financed by a massive illegal Ponzi scheme. The reckless expansion of the money supply by the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve is going to end by destroying the U.S. dollar and the value of remaining collective net worth of all Americans. The more dollars there are, the less each individual dollar is worth. In essence, inflation is like a hidden tax on each dollar that you own. When they flood the economy with more money, and that's all they had the brains to do or the courage to do, the value of the money that you have in your bank account goes down. And the growth of the U.S. money supply is increasing. So pay particular attention to what happens when they start paying debt by printing more money. And when a nation practices what we do, there's no way it's going to be blessed in the long run with balancing itself. The truth is that we've become a nation that is dripping with corruption and wickedness from the top to the bottom. Unless this fundamentally changes, not even the most perfect economic policies in the world are going to do us any good. In the end, you reap what you sow. And I believe that we are at the point of getting what we sow in the very near future. And for all those 20,000 seeking food stamps each day, for all the people who once worked at regular jobs, had regular houses, who were living the American dream, who are now sitting on the lawns of churches waiting their turn to go up and get a box of food, they're increasing. And what does the left do? It denies when people speak out against this. And what do the right do? They try to exploit it as if somehow they are the saviors when, hello, the right, for the last 8 years and for 8 years under Reagan, that's 16 years that you practice offshoring of American jobs, busting the unions, lowering the wage as much as possible, and causing as much problem as you could for the working middle class. And what did the 8 years of the Clinton administration and the 2 years of Obama do? That's 10 extra years. You enhanced your position of the corporatists getting all of the free lunch and stuffing it to the rest. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Okay. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Your turn to talk up, speak out. This is the number one forum in the world for independent and progressive-minded individuals, and I'm always interested in your thoughts. I will be on the air live on Sunday night with my satellite phone and a two-hour special this coming Labor Day. Monday, I will be live on the air at noon over the Progressive Radio Network. Not, I believe, on WMYE and not, I believe, on PFW. I believe that they will be taking time off, but I will be on the satellite live during 3 hours, two at noon and one at three. Now let's go into our studio in New York City. We're standing by as our program director for the Progressive Radio Network, Kara Lee, and our executive producer of our radio show, Richard Gale. Nice to have you both on.
Hi, Gary.
Good. Richard, let's begin with you.
Yeah, Gary. It's Labor Day weekend, so I think perhaps sticking with the labor issue and job situation in the country is apropos here, because this is probably the most bleak Labor Day weekend we've had since the Great Depression. Today you may have seen that there were the unemployment figures were released, aside from just a trumping up of previous figures, trying to show that the stimulus works, which pretty much means nothing if you just recalculate 30,000 jobs to 60,000 jobs. It's a piddle compared to the 14.6 million jobs that have been lost since the start of this recession. And what we're seeing, though, now is in the stock market, it did fall today, but we're hearing from all sides that there is these growing demands for the government to invest much, much more into the job stimulus package. And so, and many of the economists, including many in the progressive movement, are in agreement with this. And yet, there's this conundrum, is that our national debt is already conservatively $9 trillion, and that does not include the federal budget deficit, which is simply the revenue debt ratio of the domestic economy. So where do you stand on the whole debate on government increasing dramatically job stimulation in the context of adding much, much more to the current federal deficit?
I'm completely unequivocally opposed to the government spending another nickel without proper oversight, because it spends money on private contractors, major corporations, and if you look at how many people are actually employed and how much those individuals are paid based upon the amount of money they give, it is mind-numbing. For example, they gave $500 million. That's $500 million in New York State, and 57 people were employed. 57. Not 57,000. 57. And I can show this across the board. Who gets the stimulus money? Almost always the first individuals that get it are individuals associated with think tanks, corporate interests, who have had lobbyists who say, we will use the money best, and they give this money because that's how the system has been corrupted, both by Republicans and Democrats. It's no different than the legislator saying, we're against these special perks that legislators can get. And all of them do it, where we want money for ourselves. That's how they buy re-elections, by taking money poor back home, whether it's a $200 million bridge to nowhere in Alaska or in West Virginia road that Byrd was getting money for that went nowhere. It doesn't matter that the money went into a special project that very few benefited from. They can brag about the total gross dollars. So on the one hand, if we say, yes, we need stimulus, that is correct. We do need stimulus. But here's how we should do it. And it's in the details that is the issue. First and foremost, the most jobs that we could create should come from the private sector. Why? Because with the private sector, when you put money into someone's pocket, it is not the taxpayer putting money into that pocket. It is coming from the private sector. Therefore, it is cost less to hire someone in the private sector. When you hire them in the public sector, then in the public sector, we're paying that. We're paying their pensions. You can't fire the people, no matter how bad their work is, and they have endless entitlements. I'm opposed to that. Instead, I believe that we should give zero interest loans to qualified individuals. Now, how do we know who would be qualified? First, abolish completely. Throw it in the Potomac River, the entire Small Business Administration. It is inept, it is inefficient, and is incorrigibly malignant. Instead, we have outstanding individuals who have achieved recognition for their work when they were a member of private business. Now, they're retired. they no longer have to align themselves politically or ideologically or economically with the interests they once had to serve, their stockholders, their board of directors, their shareholders, or governmental agencies. Instead, they can simply tell the truth and do the best they can. Therefore, in every city and every state, you have local boards, let's just call them council of elders, men and women, who are expert in all different types of businesses. Then let's say that you, Richard Gale, you wanted to open up a business, and you wanted to open a business that does not exist now. And let's say you needed $3 million. Okay, you would apply. You would take your presentation, you would take your background, all the necessary documents, and then do a presentation where you would have a chance to make your case, and they would have a chance to question you and to see whether or not they felt that you could actually succeed, because not everyone's going to have the idea that will work. Once they have agreed that, yeah, this is a good idea, and then you're going to employ, let's say, 15 people. That's a good idea to get your business going. They would have that for every $1 million you're given as a loan, you would have to hire one employee at $30. That includes health insurance. Therefore, they're actually making a living wage. Not great, but it's better than people working for the low wages they're now working at, $6, $8, and $10 an hour. Lucky if you get 15. So now let's say you're now employing those individuals locally. That means that dollar that comes into that economy will circulate in more hands at the local level. Those people then, in turn, can pay their taxes. So you're increasing the tax base. You're getting an interest-free loan for 3 years, and then it's only 2%. So that means you have less opportunity to fail because of being underfunded during that period of time. You also then will have, every month, a requirement that you go in or over the internet or in person and speak with advisors to show them what you're doing, and if you need help, you'll have a whole team there who will be able to guide you and help you, something people don't have today. So now imagine that around the United States. If we were to give 5 million individuals, which we would have more than 5 million applying, I guesstimate we would have closer to 10 million. But let's just say we had 3 million. Let's just go conservative. If you have 3 million individuals applying for loans, and let's say we gave each one $3 million, that's not a lot of money. But in return, for that 3 million, they would be hiring 6 employees. Well, now you got 18 million people that are in the workforce that weren't there before. You would just simply put people back to work at a living wage. You would rejuvenate local communities. You would put money back into the state and city and federal budgets. You would take people off unemployment rolls, and you would have a chance to survive, and you would stop outsourcing jobs to third world countries. That would cost less than 1 month of funding our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's what's not being done. That's how we should spend the money, and that's how we should stimulate. Separately, we need to do something now about global warming. We need to reforest our country. We need to put trees, 15 million trees per state. We also need to fix our infrastructures, our schools, our bridges, our roads, and that we can hire local people to do. That would be a good way of applying our federal stimulus package dollars. So one way, it comes back to the economy and then relieves the burden of unemployed and refills the tax basket and gives people back their homes, and then at the same time reset all mortgages at the federal level to 2%, and therefore allow people a chance to stay in their homes without the foreclosure. That means you're lessening homelessness, poverty, hunger, and also a good percentage of that would end up being enormous service to the other people who are still living in a community whose homes would increase back up in value. So that would be a separate program I would engage in at the same time. I would also then increase taxes on all risky. My first joy would be to completely ban trading in all commodities essential life, meaning you could not trade in currencies, oil, water, gas, and food. But if you couldn't do that, then go to Plan B and charge them a 30% tax on all profits. that would bring over $500 billion into the federal budget per year, and that would be enough to pay for all of the other loans given that year.
Thank you, Gary. Gary, can I just want to expand a little further on the global warming issue? Because how do you understand this relationship between job creation and environmental preservation and green energies? And I'm thinking specifically of the unions, which seem only to really be concerned about job creation, sustainable employment, and increasing salaries, which is perfectly understandable. However, my sense is that given the union's druthers, if jobs meant just the further destruction of the environment for pilfering more and more natural resources and just increasing or continuing with the old technologies that have been proven to be ecologically unfriendly, simply because that's all the labor knows, then that would be perfectly fine with the union. So your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree. I am pro-union, but I am not pro-union policies in the current environment that they could be making an enormous contribution if they chose to hold general strikes and hold industries and the government accountable for the failed policies of our environment. Therefore, I believe that the government should offer all of the subsidies currently given, $27 billion to the nuclear industry and over $50 billion to the other industries combined, gas, coal, and oil, and nuclear, give that instead to clean industries, geothermal, solar, and wind. And then you inspire the young and old entrepreneurs to come out of the woodwork because you're giving them a chance to create the next mammoth a movement towards sustainability. Now, that's what I would do. And then they can hire people because they would have better use of that money. And then they would be able to turn the entire global warming issue around in favor of the public's proactivation.
Gary, construction. Because construction has always been one of the indicators for the health of an economy when we see.
I believe that we should do two things. We can do two things positive at the same time. First, we can encourage more green architecture, green building design. In fact, the only housing that would be subsidized by the government or state or city would be that which would have green all the way. So every building would have to have solar or wind or geothermal or insulation, everything made, including without tearing down all the trees any longer. There are now materials that could be made to make houses much more efficient and much more cool or warm, easy to do. So you create a whole new mindset of what's possible. Then you can go into inner city and get the state and the federal government and the city working together to reclaim hundreds of thousands of buildings, meaning millions of rooms that could be rented, not sold, using green energy and technology, and get all the brilliant engineers and architects reclaiming these buildings, hiring local people to work at these green jobs that ultimately would rehabilitate neighborhoods and whole inner cities, where then people could live there at 15% of their disposable income, so even a person on welfare could still live in a quality housing. And as the quality of housing increases, and with that parks and landscape and architecture, because you're also then bringing the same green philosophy of farmers markets and green markets and culture and arts and crafts into that same community, you virtually de-ghettoize America at the same time. And you could do that without government money. You could do that by giving 2-to-1 tax write-offs to corporations to donate to foundation of sustainable inner city development.
How about for the rural communities, Gary? Because the highest percent of unemployment is really not in the urban areas, there are in the cities.
That's
you
correct.
Find it in the rural areas.
What you could do in the rural areas is you could put rural community cooperative projects together, like building holistic long-term sustainable aging centers. So let's just say hypothetically you go out in You go out into New Jersey and you have a 500-acre area out there that otherwise would just be woods and farmland. Now you hire local rural people who are the first to be employed, who come in and build long-term sustainable project. Let's say each project could house about 2,000 people. These would be where they would have 100% self-sufficiency. They would have the farmers growing the food. They'd have greenhouses supplying it. They'd have holistic medical centers and nursing care. They would have petting zoos for the people. That animals always are very important for a person. They would have holistic care, so a person would be able to go into their senior years knowing that this is not just one stop before nursing home or death. They could actually get healthier, and yet it would be a place that they could live around other people in a beautiful environment, and the people historically had lived in that environment but now are down on their luck would have an ability to work with them and not only grow their food, build their buildings, take care of the grounds, but you could build 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 of these. You could actually build more of these centers, and we have senior citizens or older people to live in them. That would rejuvenate the rural America in a green and sustainable way, and it would depopulate the areas where now those people do not have quality of life, and now they would have a quality of life.
Gary, do you think we're doing enough with recycling as an actual industry? Because I was thinking that if all the waste of steel, aluminum, copper, and then the synthetic materials like, you know, plastics and nylon, perhaps if that was all properly recycled, be sufficient enough to supply the world, and yet we continue to put our attention on virgin resources.
That's correct, because the average person is too lazy. It is not lack of technology. We have the technology. It is lack of compliance. People just throw stuff away. And you're right, we would be able to recycle everything if we made it compliant. And also, I believe that we should be supporting technologies. I'm working on one myself where we'd have giant ships that would go out into the Pacific, an area of the Pacific that's about three times the size of Texas, has the largest mass of plastic in the world, and where it would feed in the plastic of all types and then recycle it right there on the ship. And then what you would have is you would have a reusable solids that then could be taken by other ships back into local communities. So you would have these ships out there 24/7, hundreds of them. And within 2 years, you could go through most of the debris. The technology, I'm working on the technology. One of the things people don't realize that I do is I invent. That's what I love to do. Richard, we're out of time for this segment.
Thank you, Gary.
But we'll continue our discussions next week, all right?
All right, Gary. Thank you.
Let's go over and say hello to Carolee. Hi, Carolee.
Good afternoon, Gary. I just wanted to make a quick announcement to all our listeners that the Vitamin Closet on the Upper West Side will still be open this Labor Day weekend. So even though the Vitamin Closet on the Upper East Side will be closed in the celebration of Labor Day, the Upper West Side will have its regular vitamin hours, and the Uptown Whole Foods will also be open on Monday as well. I believe we're going to have some limited hours on Monday, Gary, though, from 10 to 6?
10 to 6 at the store at 89th and Broadway, and then but noon to 6 at 83rd and Broadway at our store will be open. 92nd will be closed, so anyone who normally shop over at 92nd can shop at 83rd.
All right, Gary. And do we have time for one email before we
sure,
get out of here today?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, great. This is from Brian. He's a school teacher, and he said the other day him and his students were doing a survey and discussing the greatest engineering tech marvels from the 1900s and the Industrial Revolution. As they were going over a poll in the class, they said that the votes were split between the Eiffel Tower, the Panama Canal, and the Suez Canal. And he wanted to know what your thought was on the greatest tech marvel from the Industrial Revolution.
Okay, well, that goes back a little earlier. I would not say either any of those. It's pretty to look at. I've been up on the Eiffel Tower many times. The Suez Canal and Panama Canal, major engineering feats, but not that original. Because between the locks and the gates and the physics of hydraulic maneuvering, it's not that difficult. I would say, let me just think for a moment. What would get my vote for the best Industrial Revolution designed unique project would be the Great Eastern. Have you heard of the Great Eastern?
No.
Okay. Go back to the mid-1800s. I think it was 1852 it was conceived. I believe they started in 1854. There was a man, and this is, there's no argument in my mind. The greatest architect and engineer in history was a man named Brunel, B-R-U-N-E-L-L, an English guy. Little fella, heavy smoker. I think he smoked 40 cigars a day. Anyhow, he had already designed, he invented the first all-iron sailing ship. He designed the longest spanned bridge in the world, several of them. He designed the fastest train that had been built up to that point. So he was just a genius. And he came up with an idea of why not have a ship that could circumnavigate the world without having to stop. That meant that you had to have enough coal, which was the power at the source, which means you'd have to have about 200 people just shoveling coal to go clear around the world. And it would also be a luxury ship. He wanted a ship that would be more luxurious than anything ever built, but also more luxurious or on the same standard as the great hotels of Europe at the time. And he had a hard time getting people to believe in this because no one felt it was possible. And so he finally got a company to, by one vote, to say yes to his idea. That company would later go broke. And so he started to build the ship. Now imagine a ship. It was over 690 feet long. It weighed over 8,600 tons, and it was all iron. There had never been anything like this in history created before. I mean, that's taller than the Eiffel Tower. It's very complex. And what made the Great Eastern so unique was that because it had never been done before, he had to literally invent all of the equipment that you would make it from. So he wasn't started with something that already existed, and he simply had to make a bigger ship. He had to invent things. For example, when the Titanic had a gouge in it, it wasn't necessarily a very big gouge. It flooded with water and sank in under 2.5 hours. He had a gouge in his ship that was over 86 feet, and it never sunk. In fact, no one on board, all the passengers, never even knew it happened because he created the first double hull. He had two hulls, outside, inside, two skins, outside, inside. So if one thing happened on the outside, it would prevent anything from happening to the inside. It actually did that. And he wanted 4,000 passengers. There was never a ship that held 4,000 passengers, by the way, not before or since. And it took him years to get it built. And on the day that they were going to start construction, all of the wood that he had gotten from Sweden and Norway, it all burned to the ground one night. So then he had to rebuild the shipyard. Now, here was his problem. Imagine something that weighs 8,600 tons. How do you get it to move into the water? Because you got to build it far away from the water. So he had an architect working with him who is also considered one of the greatest nautical marine engineer in history, a man named John Scott Russell. And they were fighting all the time. And Russell said, how can you build it when if you get it built, it's just going to sit there because you know there's no locomotive engine. There's no way humans or draw horses can pull this massive weight into the water. And if you take it head first in, it could crack. It could just break. So after it was built and everyone came to the inauguration of it, it didn't move. And then for 90 days, he got every hydraulic system in the country, and they were able to move it just a foot, and he had like 300 yards to go. So finally, after like 3 months, he finally got his big ship in the water. He was right. They were all wrong. And then when it finally got in the water, he went on the ship, and to take his official picture of it now floating, and he had a stroke, and he died shortly thereafter. However, the ship did sail, and because wasn't the demand for passengers, and it was true that the ship's interior staterooms were the most beautiful in the world, compared or even exceeding any of the grand hotels, they were able to use the ship to lay down the lines, for the cable that stretched from England originally to the United States and then from all the countries to the United States. These transatlantic underground cables allowed the messages to be sent from one country to another. That was all done on the Great Eastern. And finally, I think it was about 33 years after it its maiden voyage, it was decommissioned. It was just run ashore, and then all these people went out there and just tore out all that iron. But without question, in my mind, that was the greatest engineering architectural achievement of the Industrial Revolution. And without question, Brunel was the greatest engineer in history of the world. There's been no one before or since who did what he did. And so, hope that answers the question.
Thanks so much, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more with you on Sunday evening. Jim Turner, live here on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a nice day, everyone.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.